Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
Hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I'm your host, Jason Napolitano. I have Chris Sheridan on the line. How you doing, Chris?
Doing great today. Great to be here.
I'm excited today about our show. We are doing the Initiation of the Pyramid, which is Section 7 of Manly Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages. We're going to go and cover that briefly, just to give you a flavor of it, a taste of it. Encourage you to go in and read it for yourself. It is a fantastic kind of overview, particularly the second portion of it. Actually, the third portion of it, I guess it is. It starts on page 116 in the Reader's Edition, The Pyramid Mysteries. We're going to probably cover quite a bit of that. And then other stuff as well. I'm excited to be able to get into this. Obviously, the pyramids are an interesting and popular topic. Hopefully we'll add a little bit, contextualize it a little bit for you. I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, and Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. And we have both been studying this material for many, many years now. Esoteric material, occult stuff, spiritual stuff, religious stuff, mythology, etc. So we talk about those things here on the show each week. And we're hoping that you can help support the show. I don't want to stay on this topic for too long, but I just want to encourage you to support the show. There's an option on anchor.fm/cosmiceye to be able to donate per month, 99 cents, $4.99 or $9.99 a month. Obviously, anything that you can donate would be awesome. It helps us to move forward with what we're doing. Chris and I are actually planning on starting an Ancient Wisdom Academy, which is going to start online. And then we're going to move it into the real world as soon as possible. So if you can support the show and help support us by buying our books and so on, donating what you can, check me out on cosmiceye.org or look at Chris's website at chrissheridan.com. And we're going to have more information pertaining to that as the weeks go on here. So thank you for tuning in. Let's get into the Initiation of the Pyramid. Oh, also, I wanted to thank the supporters that are supporting the show right now, by the way. Thank you, guys. We appreciate your support and your listening. So let us get into Mr. Manly Hall's Secret Teachings. So I want to read a little section to set this up that Manly Hall wrote. He said, "Supreme among the wonders of antiquity, unrivaled by the achievements of later architects and builders, the Great Pyramid of Giza bears mute witness to an unknown civilization which, having completed its predestined span, passed into oblivion. Eloquent in its silence, inspiring in its majesty, divine in its simplicity, the Great Pyramid is indeed a sermon in stone." The Great Pyramid is indeed a sermon in stone, and one that has lasted for many, many thousands of years. The first sort of evidence we have of any sort of talk about it that's written, as far as we know, besides the Egyptians themselves, is from Herodotus. He is the so-called father of history, and his accounts come from about 400 BC. I won't get into all the explanations, but suffice to say that Manly Hall thought that he was a highly revered but somewhat imaginative historian, and he quoted as his description of how the pyramids were built as colorful. But a fraudulent story to conceal the true origin or purpose of the Great Pyramid. In that he thought actually that Herodotus was probably an initiate, and so that he himself was not allowed to really speak about the true reality of what the pyramids were for. So I find that an interesting way of looking at that. So today, obviously,
sounds like from day one, you know, there's been a mystery involved with the pyramid, but even, you know, to antiquity, there's been speculation and misinformation and just the great mystery with the Great Pyramid.
Exactly. And, you know, it's still, you know, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about really quickly one of the things that's challenging. We talked a little bit about this before in shows before, but also before we got online here doing the show today. One of the challenges at looking at ancient mysteries and looking at ancient history and civilizations is the fact that we, as modern quote unquote rational thinkers, tend to run everything through our own lens of reality. And the sort of scientific materialist worldview is the prevalent worldview that we grow up with in the West, most of us. So that necessarily colors the way we see things. Now, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Mayans, ancient cultures, indigenous peoples here in this country and around the world, all types of societies that are not based on rationality and science and the sort of Western way of thinking, you know, that comes through the Greeks and Romans, viewed the world, and actually we in the West viewed the world the same way prior to the Enlightenment period and prior to, you know, the sort of ascendancy of science and philosophy and logic and rationality, viewed the world, and many people still view the world this way, mythologically speaking, symbolically. They interact with the world in a completely different lens. Everything has a specific order. Everything has a certain meaning. You know, the mythological stories are words that you actually live by, breathe. They have a depth and meaning that I think we have difficulty understanding today. You know, and the imagination and the sort of mythological spirit that existed was much more connected to a sort of archetypal or unconscious understanding of the world. It was, they were closer to the unconscious, let's say, than we are. You know, we're more we're in a realm of thinking dominated, sort of a thinking dominated kind of paradigm, right? So. You know, mm-hmm. That's a challenge then for us. So we've got to try to put ourselves in the mindset of those are, you know, those earlier cultures if we want to try and understand them. Would you agree with that?
Well, definitely, and it's true that we can't really look. It's almost like a different language. We even try to look at the words of ancient scriptures and texts with a way that we look at words today.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they may have been words back then as well, they were known to be parables, allegories, metaphorical stories and symbols that lead towards something else. We tend to look at the letter and it's literal and it's exactly, and it's in black and white, and this is what it says, and you can spell check it and fact check it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just as factual back then. Or with this different type of mind. But what has been gleaned from it goes far beyond the actual words and is far more significant.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And there's a depth or sort of a profundity or sort of a, you know, a symbolic understanding that goes well beyond the kind of surface literal understanding that we make of things. And, you know, there's even... obviously, there's going to be great challenges, though, you know, despite the fact that they understand basically what the hieroglyphs say. There's still a, you know, there's a great divide. You know, we especially in that time, in the 1800s, you know, that was the age of the beginning of, you know, materialism and rationality. So, you know, there was necessarily this sort of scientific way of viewing this material. So, you know, I think that we have to remember that there were probably many different understandings of the symbolic language that was written on in the temples and inside the different burial chambers and all of the different papyrus scrolls and so forth that they found, even though, you know, with the Rosetta Stone, they did Champollion and I think Taylor was the Englishman that worked on that. We're able to crack the hieroglyphics code. There's still some doubts as to whether or not they understood the deeper meanings behind some of those symbols, and people are still trying to crack those codes today, and we'll continue to do so, and I'm sure into the future, and probably find greater and greater depth as time goes on.
The example of that in this chapter and having to do with the pyramids, the Sphinx that's in front of the pyramid plaza, is just that. If you want to just maybe mention that and get that out of it, because it goes into what we were just saying about the symbolic or the literal.
Mm. Yeah, good point. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about the Oedipus story and the riddle and so on, and share that with the listeners and set that allegory up.
Has to do with Oedipus. There are several tellings of the riddle of the Sphinx, and it appears in several myths, but definitely most popular is the Oedipus story. But essentially, to gain entrance, you were confronted by this Sphinx, and it would ask a riddle. If you successfully answered the riddle, you could gain passage. Otherwise, and according to some stories, you will suffer a painful death if you answer incorrectly. But the question is essentially this: what animal is it that in the morning goes on 4 feet, at noon on 2 feet, and in the evening on 3 feet? Now, this is fairly familiar in occult sciences, so we may know the answer to it, but I think it's more important is how that answer is derived and what that means to an allegorical symbolic question, this riddle. There's two things going on. The feet, you think, well, okay, what creature has 4 legs and then it has 2 legs and then 3 legs or feet? Can't really look at them entirely as being your own feet because that doesn't work. And the timing of it, that this creature in the morning has 4, at noon has 2, in the evening 3, those are symbolic. So if you try to think of a 24-hour period and a time of day, you're not going to get the answer right. And that would be a very literal approach to solving this question. And the answer is man, a human being, an individual, that in the morning, being in the youth, the baby, early childhood stage, you're crawling on all 4s. So you have 4 feet. In the adult stage, at noon, you're talking about the time of within a person's life, this middle part, we're walking on 2 feet. And then in the evening, some people call it the autumn of your years, when you're getting older, that maybe use a cane or something, a crutch to hobble around on. And that's the third foot, so 3 feet. So you have to look at the feet symbolically, but where it really tricks you is this morning, noon, and evening. And if you look at them as a 24-hour period, you're lost. But if you look at them as different phases or stages of our own lives, well, then you're really onto something. So that's where the literal interpretation will not help you.
Yeah.
Having to look at a more symbolic one, so it ties in with what we're talking about. That's one example of.
Well, then I like also how he goes on underneath that, the picture of the Sphinx, where it says Oedipus and the Sphinx, and it says there's still another answer to the riddle, an answer best revealed by a consideration of the Pythagorean values of numbers, or Pythagorean. The 4, the 2, and the 3 produce the sum of 9, which is that natural number of man and also of the lower worlds. The 4 represents the ignorant man, the 2, the intellectual man, and 3, the spiritual man. Infant humanity walks on 4 legs, evolving humanity on 2 legs, and the power of his own mind, the redeemed and illuminated magus, or magician, or wise man, adds the staff of wisdom. The Sphinx is therefore the mystery of nature, the embodiment of the secret doctrine, and all who cannot solve her riddle perish. And so it's interesting that the Sphinx is guarding the pyramids, essentially, and it's a clue to I think the understanding that and the mindset that one needs in order to investigate the mysteries of those ancient monuments. So
very good,
great point bringing up that Sphinx. So, like Oedipus, you have to answer that riddle, but within your own mind and be able to approach the study symbolically and esoterically. So, it's interesting because the Great Pyramid, just kind of physically, obviously they're awe-inspiring. We still, there's so many debates as to how they were made and so on. And that's all the sort of physical aspect of it. That is what I think is interesting about how you know, today a lot of these different arguments about how the pyramids were made or who they came from or where you know when they were constructed and so forth, they all seem to a lot of the arguments seem to revolve around technology. And again, that technological viewpoint, that sort of using a material argument or a sort of historical materialist point of view, you know, is a very modern way of looking at things. And even some of our more imaginative and creative ways of explaining the pyramids generally involve some sort of higher technological advancement or higher technology from somewhere else. For example, people talk about ancient aliens these days. Those are popular explanations of how the pyramids were made. And that is certainly possible. I'm not arguing that it isn't, but I think it's indicative of our sort of materialist mindset, in that instead of looking for a spiritual or symbolic or mythological sort of understanding or even the possibility that it isn't some sort of a technology, but maybe some sort of a spiritual endeavor that helped to create the pyramids, we think, well, it must have been a, you know, a superior life form from some other galaxy that created these monuments. So again, that's a technological argument. You're saying
that's our viewpoint.
And so, you know, and a lot of these people, and again, I'm not saying it's not true. It's quite possible that it's true. I can't say there's no life anywhere else, and I can't say that they didn't bring technology that we did not have. It's quite possible. However, it's like I said, it's indicative of the way we look at things also. You know, and I think one of that viewpoint that, for example, possibly aliens will come at some point and share with us some greater technology than we have to solve all of our technological problems. Well, it's like, you know, the technology is what has caused a lot of the problems that we have with the environment, with our own psychological system, with the breakdown of families and so on. Technology is the problem in a lot of cases. Granted, that
when it's our blind reliance on it,
deferring
our own common sense to, well, if we just have the better algorithm or face recognition, well, use your eyes.
Exactly.
But we want to trust the computer that an imperfect person programmed.
Oh, exactly. And I think that, you know, we take, and also then we complicate things to a great deal. I mean, the earth itself is the most efficient sort of source of life that we can possibly know of, you know, and it's a perfectly balanced system that, you know, we as human beings have sort of gotten in the way of its natural order and its natural balance, through our, you know, through our sort of messing about with it, with our technology, with our technological advancements. And granted, again, a lot of these technologies are fantastic. I mean, obviously we wouldn't be doing this podcast if it were not for technology. Mm-hmm. We would not be talking on these cell phones if it were not for technology. All these things are fantastic. I'm not knocking technology. I'm not a Luddite. But at the same time, you know, we overcomplicate a lot of things and we look for answers through our own lens, and we have to remember sometimes to shift that to thinking in a different way, you know, a mythological, a spiritual, an esoteric way, which means we need to study some of these ancient wisdoms and go deeper and meditate and, you know, remember the power of ritual and symbol and look at the great artwork of the past and so on, and look for clues. It is there. So there, you know, the truths are out there, certainly, just like the X-Files, the truth is out there, right?
Well, the truth is also in there.
There you go.
In you.
Indeed.
And that's where we even get the word etymologically. One, I guess, approach is that pyramid, like P-Y-R, like a pyre, like a funeral pyre or a pyromaniac having to do with fire.
Fire, yeah.
And mid, the fire in the middle. And that's this, our solar plexus in the middle of our center of our bodies, that this fire inside, you know, the passion or the spirit within, the, you know, the Christ in you or the internal Buddha nature. Lots of cultures have, you know, described this, but that's another symbolism of the pyramid, that you know, we become the pyramid, that we are this structure that brings down the information and the power and the presence from above, and it emanates out into our bodies or pulls out from within.
Yeah, great point. Great point. And I think that was Manly Hall makes an interesting point too, where he talked about the capstone on the pyramid. Oh, the capstone's gone.
Yeah.
And you know, they're not really sure whether or not the capstone was ever even there, possibly. You know, that's
that the humans can only go so far, that the divine power is the only thing that can be complete.
Yeah, exactly, which I found fascinating. And then at some point then, you know, that the pyramid becomes symbolic really of us and the pyramid itself as a symbol of a sort of the fire, the holy fire, or the kind of you want to call it the one divine flame, he calls it, which is the life within every creature, that spirit, which we all share.
Definitely.
That's an interesting, he's got a different bark today. Oh no, you're in a different spot. So it's resonating a little differently. I like that.
Daily dog.
God bless him. He is.
Maybe it's a Sphinx in training. Yeah. Who knows?
He is.
Or Anubis.
He's
Jackal.
He's Anubis. He's guiding a soul to the weighing of the heart, which that actually takes place in the Book of the Dead there, where Anubis guides the recently deceased to weigh his heart, and it has to be lighter than a feather, or he will not. What was that sound, by the way? Did you hear that?
No.
There's a lot of interesting sounds going on. That one sounded. This is what it sounded like. Like chips being shuffled, like poker chips being shuffled. So
yeah,
I'm always like that scene in Manhattan, when Woody Allen moves to the cheaper apartment, and he's like, "What is that? What is that sound? It sounds like someone, sawing a what is it? What did he say? Someone's sawing a tuba or no, not a tuba. I can't even remember. That's a great line. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. So back to the pyramids. So here's the thing. Here are a couple of the ideas. We're going to get into a more symbolical, mythological, and spiritual sort of approach to what the pyramids probably mean, because I like that you touched on that with that fire, the meaning of the word, the etymology of the word. Here, obviously, a couple or few of the ideas that people have for the pyramids so far. These are some of the theories. So like a landing pad, or some sort of a symbolic representation to guide UFOs back. Giant power generators. Some people believe they were possibly generators of some sort of energy, and they look at Tesla's work with wireless energy transmission and so on, and postulate that they were some sort of a generator, electrical generators. Astrological or astronomical observatories, calendar to measure seasons or when the Nile would flood, some sort of marker signifying the placement of stars or planets or galaxies, etc. There's different theories about that. They've been called resurrection machines for the pharaohs. They were built solely to make sure that the pharaohs were resurrected into the next life properly. And then there's other theories out there altogether. Perhaps they were all of those things. Perhaps they were none of those things. I think the interesting part of it, though, is that the one thing that often gets lost in all of these speculations, again, is the spiritual or the esoteric understanding of what the pyramids signify. And that's what we're going to get into a little bit in this section, which starts 116 in the Reader's Edition of the Secret Teachings. And it's called The Pyramid Mysteries. And I want to read a little section of this because Manly Hall really lays this out beautifully. This gets into numbers and some of the symbolism of the pyramids, not so much in the measurements, but just in the different sides of the pyramid and so forth. So the square base of the pyramid is a constant reminder that the house of wisdom is firmly founded upon nature and her immutable laws. The Gnostics, writes Albert Pike, claimed that the whole edifice of their science rested on a square whose angles were silence, profundity, intelligence, and truth. And that was from Morals and Dogma. The sides of the Great Pyramid face the four cardinal angles, the latter signifying, according to Eliphas Levy, the extremities of heat and cold, south and north, respectively, and the extremities of light and darkness, east and west. The base of the pyramid further represents the four material elements or substances from the combinations of which the quaternary body of man is formed, being earth, air, fire, and water. From each side of the square, there rises a triangle, typifying the threefold divine being enthroned within every quaternary material nature, and that would be mind, spirit, and soul. I'm adding that. Manly Hall didn't say that. If each baseline be considered a square from which ascends a threefold spiritual power, then the sum of the lines of the four faces, 12, and the four hypothetical squares, 16, constituting the base, is 28, which is the sacred number of the lower world, otherwise known as the Tetractys, the ten number pyramid of Pythagoras, the 10 spheres of the Kabbalistic tree of life. If this be added to the three septenaries composing the sun, that's septenaries of seven, composing the sun, it equals 21. That equals 49, the square of seven, and the number of the universe. Number of the universe. And he goes on to note that the 12 signs of the zodiac are there and so forth. So there's a lot of deep symbolism in the pyramids themselves, just looking at the outer construction, just looking at the number symbology. One of the things that he brings up, which I think is really cool, he talks about the three main chambers of the pyramid are related to the heart, the brain, and the generative system, the spiritual centers of the human constitution. The triangular form of the pyramid also is similar to the posture assumed by the body during the ancient meditative exercises. I think that's a clue. I think that's a clue to understand the pyramids. Maybe one needs to be in a meditative state or in an altered state of consciousness.
Well, we see all those colossal figures all throughout the Nile Valley, Nazareth, just about every temple have a symbol that these figures, these people, maybe they're pharaohs, maybe they're mystics, but they're always seated. Mm-hmm. They're always sitting.
Yep.
And their hands are on their knees.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't really see the pupil, so maybe that's their eyelids. Maybe they were adorned at one point. But to me, it always looks like they're meditating. They're sitting there straight up, hands on their knees, in a more Western meditation pose as opposed to a lotus.
Yeah, exactly.
But it just seems they're already in a meditative state just all over the place. Just
that's
hundreds
a great
of
point.
Statues.
Yeah, and most
depicting
of,
that.
Most of the Western types of meditation, the magical, Kabbalistic, ceremonial magic type meditation is done in that so-called Egyptian pose or Egyptian posture. In fact, I think one of the early writers on ceremonial magic and one of the more important ones, Aleister Crowley, pointed out that that was probably the best posture for Western people to use.
It works for me because I'm, full-time wheelchair user. So
yeah,
it's a lot easier than getting on the floor and trying to fold my legs up. I just sit in my chair, and I do try to put my feet on the floor though. So it's more grounded than on the footrest of my chair.
Exactly. That is important. It is that grounding. Actually, the middle pillar exercise that Israel Gardi leads in one of his tapes. Actually, that's on YouTube, if you just look up Regardi, R-E-G-A-R-D-I-E, middle pillar, there's an excellent guided meditation that uses that very Egyptian position. It's a fantastic meditation. So that's an interesting point that's made there, and may help us to understand how the mindset that we need to get into in order to go deeper into the mysteries in general. Specifically, the pyramid mysteries. The other thing I wanted to look at is a great little paragraph. I want to read this again. We were talking about this earlier, but the difference between our mindset now and the ancient mindset. So, Manly Hall says on page 119. Reader's Edition, Secret Teachings of All Ages. Though the modern world may know a million secrets, the ancient world knew one, and that one was greater than the million. For the million secrets breed death, disaster, sorrow, selfishness, lust, and avarice. But the one secret confers light, confers life, light, and truth. The time will come when the secret wisdom shall again be the dominating religious and philosophical urge of the world. And then he goes on. But that's, you know, that one secret, we'll get into that at the end. But that one secret is the most important secret, really, to the pyramids, in I believe, in general. So
again, it is, and you could even make the parallel that it's the heart of Taoism.
Yeah, good call.
That there is the undifferentiated one that you can't really depict or describe or really even see. And then it gets divided into the two of yin and yang. And then from there, breed the 10,000 things, this multiplicity of stuff of the world.
Yeah.
But before, or in the Big Bang Theory, you know, there's singularity before the explosion and dissemination of all the galaxies and star stuff,
mm-hmm.
That at some point this contained, it was a singular thing. So this one story, this one myth, this one truth, is far more significant than all the millions of little truths and stuff out there.
Exactly. So exactly.
It is recurring story.
And that the truth, the secret that I will reveal in the last paragraph, and I'll talk about at the end of the show, is definitely related to that unity and that unified theory, oneness that we all share. All right. So one thing that Manly Hall talked about, I want to also point out another great YouTube resource. If you look up Initiation of the Pyramid, the Initiation of the Pyramid, Manly Hall on YouTube, you'll see several people who have copies of his discussion, which follows pretty closely this chapter we're talking about. But one thing that he got into that was really interesting that is not in this particular chapter is he talked about how Manly Hall talked about how in 820 AD, a caliph called Mamun went and visited and took with him some men to excavate the pyramid. They believed there was treasure there. The point really to the whole story, I won't get into the whole story about that. You can read about it in the book, and he talks about it also in that lecture. But the point of it is that at that time in 820 AD, the pyramids were still completely sealed, covered over. There's casing stones on the outside of them. We see them now as these sort of stepped pyramids. And some of them were built like that, stepped. Some of the older, or not the older ones, but some of the smaller ones. The Great Pyramid, however, had casings on it. So it had a smooth surface. These casings were they granite or limestone? I know one was granite.
Limestone.
Okay, so the outside casings were limestone, and they were smooth. And he spoke of them as being smooth as glass and shiny at this time. And there was no entrance that could be seen. So they had to actually cut their way in using what was quote unquote primitive iron. I guess the vinegar was used to as an acid or something that helped to cut the stone. I'm not exactly sure, but at this time the pyramids were completely closed off. So Manly Hall was talking about how possibly they had been like that the entire time, most likely. And then he said, well, either then there was probably a secret entrance, which has not been found, for example, the initiates, basically Manly Hall's whole conjecture in this chapter is that these pyramids were used for an initiatory purposes.
Yeah.
Initiatory purposes. So essentially it was a sort of a ritual that bestowed an immortality upon the person who went through these rituals. So what he said was then possibly Plato, who was supposedly initiated into the Egyptian mysteries, for example, maybe traveled astrally outside of the body. Perhaps there was a way that the Egyptians used to travel, the soul traveled outside of the body, the confines of the body, and then astrally projected itself inside the pyramid, and that ritual was done that way. So he postulates that was one possibility. Again, said, or maybe sort of a secret entrance. So there were some chambers below where those initiations were done. So really Manly Hall's whole idea, to agree with him, is that the pyramids were some sort of either symbolic initiatory complex, or they were a sort of physical material temple for an initiation of possibly pharaohs or very high level initiates, which conferred upon them this understanding and this knowledge. He relates that then, not in this, but in other places, to Freemasonry and how ancient Egypt is the sort of model or the prototype upon which Freemasonry is built, and connects a lot of the symbols to that ancient rite. And I find that very interesting, and I think an important connection. There is actually a great book that Manly Hall did called, I was going to get into this at the end, but that's a good segue into it. Freemasonry of the Ancient Egyptians, which is, you can get it on Amazon, and it's a paperback, and I think it's like $10 or $11. That is a fantastic a book. And then Ledbetter's book, Ledbetter, Ledbetter, who is a famous theosophist. Freemasonry and its Ancient Mystic Rites is excellent. So those are two really great sources to see those Freemasonry and Ancient Egypt connections.
And he hints toward about this ritual or perhaps a rite or initiation that might take place. He goes through the mystic passageways and chambers of the Great Pyramid, past the illumined of antiquity. They entered its portals as men. They came forth as gods. It was the place of the second birth, the womb of the mysteries.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
So some transformative.
Some sort of transformative process took place there.
And as rituals should, you know, rites of passage, you know, you should be a little bit different than before having gone through it, because it is an experience. So it would have been a visceral experience. There's exactly. Some notion that maybe there was a cross in there, a sideways cross, like an X, crucifying the material part of man and the tomb, you know, that part which is dead in the world. And then what remains is this living spirit. So it's a real, you know, second birth.
Exactly.
That so, someone would go through.
And on that note, that is actually the great secret that I talked about earlier. This one secret that the pyramids are pointing at, Manly Hall believes, and a lot of the esoteric and occult initiates and leaders spoke about this. So I'm going to read this last paragraph because it's fantastic. The dying gods shall rise again. The secret room in the house of the hidden places shall be rediscovered. The pyramid again shall stand as the ideal emblem of solidarity, inspiration, aspiration, resurrection, and regeneration. As the passing sands of time bury civilization upon civilization beneath their weight, the pyramid shall remain as the visible covenant between eternal wisdom and the world. The time may yet come when the chants of the illumined shall be heard once more in its ancient passageways, and the master of the hidden house shall await in the silent place for the coming of that man who, casting aside the fallacies of dogma and tenet, seeks simply truth and will be satisfied with neither substitute nor counterfeit. So then essentially that secret that's hidden is that there is an eternal part of yourself. There is an essential sort of a spirit within man, which does not die, which is resurrected, which never dies and is never born. And that's what you were talking about earlier, connecting it to the Tao and that sort of eternal energy source from which we come. And that really is his message of what the pyramid is, whether or not that there were actually you know, rites or initiatory rituals that took place in the pyramids. They stand as a symbol of that idea. And we need to remember that more than ever today, especially with our lack of rites and rituals and symbolic understanding. And that's one of the poverties I think that we have in this material age. We have a wealth of stuff, We have a wealth of stuff and a poverty of spirit and spiritual understanding and wisdom. And, you know, through working with this material, you know, we can begin to kind of reconnect with that. And that's why Manly Hall, I believe, is such an important teacher, is that he shares these truths in a pretty simple way, but also in a very profound way, and you know, goes deeply into them. But that there's something for everyone in his work, and that's one of the beauties of Manly Hall. And I think that's something that we try to do on this show every week, is kind of hint at things and point at stuff and give you some clues, give you some other resources to look at and so forth, so that you can begin to create meaning in your own life. And that might be something as simple as doing a little bit of meditation, taking time to study some mythology, whether it's Egyptian or, you know, Native American or African or whatever. Maybe creating some kind of ritual for yourself that you do. And there's some great books and resources even on YouTube about, you know, basic rituals and so on. But just trying to reconnect with that symbolic and that mythological understanding that ancient man had. And it's still in us. Archetypally speaking, it's still in us, right? I mean, that stuff doesn't die, right, Chris?
No, it doesn't. It's, you know, whatever death it has is because we have cut ourselves off from it. It's still there. We are the ones that are suffering.
Yeah.
through this disconnection. The source is fine. We are the ones who are impoverished. We are the ones who are out of balance because we haven't maintained that connection, you know, with the higher things. And we were talking about a meditation to, you know, maybe connect with this. One thing I've done a couple times is I've gone in, and I've seen pictures and video and stuff of inside the King's Chamber, where there's the open sarcophagus and really nothing else in this room.
Yeah.
Is to, you know, project yourself in there, remote view yourself. And they're maybe lying in that sarcophagus, and just sitting in that space where you're complete. It's in the middle of the pyramid, and you're completely surrounded by this world's largest building.
Yeah.
And what is that? And just let it go from there. Look at the walls. Is there a writing? Are there other people? Is
sure.
This? Are you alone in there? What can you hear? What is your breathing sound like? And you know, and then crawl yourself out of the sarcophagus and then, you know, get done with meditation. But as a way of just, you know, maybe connecting with that without really looking at an answer or saying, well, this is because of that and this symbolizes sure. that. Just put yourself there
put
and
yourself
let the mystery
there.
Unfold.
That's
let
a
the
really,
pyramid speak to you.
No, that's a really great way of looking at it. And, you know, so often I think we think that the mysteries are secrets that we're going to figure out by reading them or by finding them or by someone else telling us what they are. And you know, those are just the hints. The real secrets are what you just talked about there, the experiential knowledge that you get, the gnosis or the knowing that you have in connection with those experiential events and those altered states of consciousness, the meditative explorations and so forth. Great point and a great little exercise. Thank you for sharing that. All right, so I want to share actually a really quick prayer that I was going to do at the beginning but forgot, and so I'm going to share this at the end here. This is a translated prayer from Papyrus. This is a prayer of thanks, and it goes a little something like this. Holy Isis, Holy Osiris, we give you thanks that your love, beauty, and truth are manifest with power and peace throughout all spheres, within all beings, and we accept your blessings now in mind and heart. It's like a prayer of thanksgiving or blessing that the ancient Egyptians would use. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. That is going to about do it for us today. Unfortunately, we are at the end of our show. I want to give you a couple of extra resources, and Chris may have some to add too. Like I said previously, Ledbetter. Ledbetter's Freemasonry and its Ancient Mystic Rites. Another great book is a more modern book. This is John Anthony West's book, Serpent in the Sky, and he lays out a lot of the information from Schwaller de Lubitsch, who is the next one I'm going to recommend. R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, and I'll put that name on the description of the podcast so you can find that. Some of his books include The Temple of Man, A Study of Numbers, Sacred Science, and then a book called Herbach, H-E-R-B-A-K, which is a sort of fictionalized version of what life was like in ancient Egypt, which is fantastic, and more books by him as well. And then, of course, Manly Hall's Secret Teachings, Lost Keys of Freemasonry, Freemasonry of the Ancient Egyptians. Anything else that you can think of that might be a great resource for them to understand ancient Egypt and symbolism, et cetera?
Yeah, well, Lost Keys by Manly Hall, that's very easily available. And there's some illustrations that show a, you know, a projected maybe or an imagined ritual going on in the King's Chamber, so it can even put you closer there. It's a really good visual. By the illustrator who did all the color plates of the Secret Teachings, he also illustrated
And that would be
the Lost Keys of Freemasonry.
That would be Mr. Knapp of blessed memory.
Yes. And it's even just the connection with Masonry itself, you know, with the pyramid and these ancient builders and the architects that trued the stone, you know, a lot of that symbolism and metaphors, these allegories really are part of the, you know, DNA of Freemasonry. You know, this link to the pyramid and,
exactly,
and its builders. And it wasn't uncommon in ancient times to have any kind of a guild. If you were a stone cutter, if you were you know, a medicine person, whatever it is that you did, you were part of some guild with your trade. And it was very spiritual as well, that you were doing the work of the gods. You were the hands and feet for the master.
Mm.
So this reverence for the mysterious builders of the pyramids certainly you know, influenced the Masonic stories.
Great point. Thank you for sharing. And again, please support us if you're at all able. anchor.fm/cosmiceye. You can find the place where you can make a donation there. Check out our books. I'm the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Chris's Spirit in the Sky. And both of those are available on Amazon or on our websites, cosmiceye.org or chrissheridan.com. Thank you again for listening. We appreciate all your support. Please like us, you know, give your feedback. If you want to hear a specific subject, go ahead and leave a message. That, again, can be done through anchor.fm. You can record a message there through your phone, and we can actually put you on and answer your question if you wish, or we can just talk about it on the show. Anyway, thanks again. Have a great week. We appreciate your listening and your support. Goodbye and God bless.